My name is Matt. I'm a volunteer at WBAI. The WBAI Community Advisory Board will be holding an open meeting for all to attend on Sunday, June 12th at 1 p.m. The meeting will be held at the 60 Wall Street Atrium in Lower Manhattan. Again, the WBAI Community Advisory Board will be holding an open meeting for all to attend on Sunday, June 12th at 1 p.m. The meeting will be held at the 60 Wall Street Atrium in Lower Manhattan. 2 or 3 train to Wall Street. All are welcome to attend.
WBAI is not only a progressive free speech radio station, but it is also your opportunity for several perks through the BAI Buddy System. Becoming a buddy is simple. Donate as little as $10 on a monthly basis, thus forming a relationship that benefits you, the listener, and us here at 99.5 FM. After becoming a buddy, you'll receive a WBAI tote bag and a membership card that enables you to enjoy discounted services at Zipcar, Bacchus French Bistro, Revolution Books, and more locations in the New York region. Simply visit give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org. And donate today. We are a listener-supported radio station. But as a buddy, WBAI can also support you.
WBAI is a media sponsor of Vision 21, New York's longest-running jazz festival. It starts June 5th with films on the Sun Ra Orchestra at Anthology Film Archives and moves to Judson Memorial Church from the 7th through 12th for nightly live avant-garde jazz, poetry, dance, and visual art. Acts include the Sun Ra Orchestra, Jerry Allen, Wadada Leo Smith, and more, honoring the career of bassist Henry Grimes. See artsforart.org for the schedule. That's arts with an S for art.org.
I said, you're my love. Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life. Electric word, life, it means forever, and that's a mighty long time. But I'm here to tell you, there's something else. The afterworld. A world of never-ending happiness. You can always see the sun, day or night. So when you call up that shrink in Beverly Hills, you know the one. Doctor, everything will be all right. Instead of asking the mama to your time, sir, ask him how much of your mind, baby. Cause in this life, things are much harder than in the afterworld. This life, you're on your own. And if the elevator tries to break you down, we'll be right back.
you're tuned to Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight. I'm Catherine in studio with
Paulette Spencer.
Yes, Catherine Davis, also known as Kathy Davis. So we wanted to wish Prince a happy birthday. Apparently his birthday was yesterday. And since we recently lost Prince to the realm of the ancestors, it's nice to celebrate his birthday as well. And he was one sexy dude, I thought.
Yeah.
He was a pretty sexy guy. A little bit androgynous, but still just amazing. I went to this little disco gathering thing yesterday, and it was too noisy for my old ears, so I couldn't stay very long. But they were showing this video. It had nothing to do with the music. The music was pounding, and he was on the video. And you could just see him dancing and moving, and it reminded me how exciting he was as a performer. It's pretty amazing. Prince Rogers Nelson, yeah. So we played that song, Let's Go Crazy. And you were saying Josephine Baker is also having a birthday this month?
I think so, and I'm not sure what the date is, but I understand she was born in June.
June, okay. So we're going to play a piece by Josephine Baker, and we're also going to play...
Josephine Baker.
It's about Josephine Baker, sorry. Al Stewart, about Josephine Baker. And we're going to do a Simon and Garfunkel song, The Boxer, and that is in honor of Muhammad Ali, who also passed away very recently. Was it just a couple of days ago, right?
Yes.
So we'll be back. We'll have a bit of a chat and invitation for all of you to call in and join us with your thoughts. We are having a brief respite between fun drives, such as it is. And so it's always nice to reconnect during these times. So let's hear a little bit about Josephine Baker.
I was watching TV late last night, and a scene transported me. Long gone figures came back to life in a documentary. Though I saw them dance for joy, I was sad I missed that show. If I had a time machine, I know just where I'd go. I was born too late to see Josephine Baker dancing in a pirate's cabaret. Born too late to see Josephine. She just lit up the stage. You can put on all that gloss and still not have the feel. What's inside will come across, and only real is real. I was born too late to see Josephine Baker dancing in a Paris cabaret. Born too late to see Josephine dancing in a Paris cabaret. Born too late to see Josephine Baker. She must have been great in her heyday.
I'm sometimes trapped by the close confines of the age I'm born into. Though there were others worse than mine, well, I miss what I can't do. Join the feast of ancient Greece, see Alexander's library. Maybe clink a champagne toast with a jazz age dancing queen. I was born too late to see Josephine Baker dancing in a Paris cabaret. Born too late to see Josephine Baker dancing in a Paris cabaret. In black and white film, you can't mistake her, she must have been great in her.
Just a poor boy, though my story is seldom told. I squandered my resistance for a pocket full of mumbles, such are promises. All lies and jest, still the man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest. No more than a boy in the company of strangers, in the quiet of the railway station, when I'm scared. Laying low, seeking out the poor quarters where the ragged people go, looking for the places only they would know. Lie-la-lie, lie-la-lie-lie, lie-la-lie. Asking only workmen's wages, I come looking for a job, but I get no offers. Just to come home from the wars on 7th Avenue. I do declare there were times when I was so lonesome, I took some comfort there. La 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 la.
La 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 la.
And so that was Simon and Garfunkel. And a tribute to the late, great Muhammad Ali. I am the greatest. Well, so a lot of people seem to be making their transition these days. And I guess it's always been that way. But it seems like a lot. I don't know. but, you know, it's one of those things. I am not one who believes in endings. I believe and feel confident that life goes on and on in different modes and forms. And so it's nice. We don't get stuck. We don't get stuck here. We don't get stuck there. We just keep moving around and moving through passages of time and space. So I think that that's pretty cool. So what has your week been like, Paulette?
Oh, my goodness. Very busy, very hectic, and focused. And that's been a wonderful thing. So,
Do I have on your mic?
I can hear you. Yeah.
I do.
No, I have a schedule where I get to start working a little bit later than many people with 9 to 5s. Mine starts at 10. So I just love the fact that I can get up extra early and have like a whole 3 hours to myself before I actually officially start my business day. So I can take care of myself and I'm not racing after a clock.
Well, that's pretty cool. That's really nice. And it's nice when your schedule actually allows for that.
Yes.
I don't think in my entire working career, I could probably count on my hands how many times I actually got to work on time.
Okay.
But
all right.
It's just one of those things. 'Cause for that very reason. The more I wake up very early, it's not a problem getting up, but getting mobilized to leave the house and to is what takes time for me. And now that I don't have a regular 9 to 5, it may be 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening.
Okay.
Before I make my way into doing something else. But I do tend to be, I wake up really, really early, maybe between 3 and 5. Usually I wake up. And then I am very clear and very, I do a lot of thinking, writing, working, meditating.
Wonderful.
I could do a lot of work in the morning. But by 7 o'clock, I'm ready to go back to sleep.
Okay.
So I take a nap.
So you really listen to your body.
Yeah, I'm really blessed at this moment in time that I have that, that space in my life to do that, to really focus and to live according to my own body clock. Except now, this is not really my prime time to be up and about. But it's nice. It's a nice, mellow space to be in. And so today I've been working on actually a new research project. Well, not just today, last couple of days I've been working on a new research project and looking into the Aboriginal civilization. And it's really a global civilization. And when we look at it from the lens of the 21st century and the kind of history that we have had and the kind of miseducation that we have had, we have a tendency to separate things. You know, well, these people were in the continent of Africa, these people are in Australia, these people are in America, and these people are in North America. And truthfully, indigenous or Aboriginal people didn't really identify themselves with the land. They identified themselves with their ancestors, with their culture. And so there was a lot in which they, you know, they usually had, were considered considered themselves to be nations themselves. They don't really think of themselves as tribes. So it's kind of interesting to see that when you look at the Aboriginal indigenous culture on a global scale, you can really see the connections, and you can see that it's regionally different in the sense that the languages are different regionally. Even within a continent, regional languages are different. But when you look at deeper into the cultures, you can see that this is a global culture. It's a unified culture. And these were people who were very advanced through antiquity. And I think maybe at the point that the rise of the Christian church and the rise of colonialism, probably I would say that a lot of the Aboriginal cultures of antiquity were in decline already. So they may not have known from where their pyramids came. But it's interesting to see that these relationships, and that there isn't this strong division between continents. There isn't a strong division between race. And it's a lot of the color differences and racial differences are more a consequence of geography than anything else. But if you look at the culture overall, you see a great, respect for ancestors. You see a great respect for living in harmony with the environment, with nature. And so it's kind of interesting to see that. And one of the reasons that I had began to travel down this path is because I had been having a conversation with someone about this whole idea of being as in this country, because being called an African American. And I never really have to say, I never really identified with that when that term first came out, because I didn't know very much about Africa at the time. But also, I had a strong relationship through my mother's matrilineal line, which was indigenous to New York, and so I have a much stronger pull to the culture of America than I ever did to the culture of Africa. So, and then as I learned more about the name Africa, and when I was studying with for a brief time with the Dogon people, they were saying that, well, Africa is not the real name of the continent. It's a name given to it by Greeks or Romans or something like that. And so the very fact that it carries that name means that it is a product of colonization. A lot of what's going on in that continent is a product of colonization. And so a lot of the indigenous peoples of that continent were driven underground, such as the Dogon people, and they, like the Mayans and the Aztecs in Central and South America, where the wisdom teachings went into the underground and was just handed down through family lineage or through different teachings and apprenticeships. But it's interesting that now all of these teachings are starting to resurface. And as I study that, and as I'm looking at early history of the colonial world, I'm really seeing how much people are really Aboriginal and very connected to the earth. And what we experience in our modern culture is very unnatural. I mean, of course we know that because we feel it, but there's real evidence for that. And so I'm doing a lot of research on that. I've come across a couple of authors of books written in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And the authors are European, they're out of the I would say, the colonial system. But there are two kinds of authors. There are the earlier authors that are in the 1800s who are kind of appalled at what's happening to indigenous people. And then, I've found some journals of missionaries and some journals of early explorers who came before, all of the settlers came. And so they were basically living with the Aboriginal indigenous people, so they had a much better understanding of the culture, so they could write from a perspective of learning to communicate, learning to speak the language, learning to negotiate and explore, and actually living more or less harmoniously with the indigenous people of this country. And so then there's this other grouping of authors who are more early 1900s, and they're not so much identifying with indigenous or Aboriginal people, but they're also not quite in sync with the whole, colonial effort to create genocide across the land. And so there was this group of authors who made an effort to document, so that the history wouldn't be lost. And I find it interesting because I don't think any of these authors considered that Aboriginal, Indigenous, Black, Brown, Red people would still be around reading it 200, 300 years later. I think they were writing it for themselves. So why I make that observation, because of some of what they're really talking about, is like very, I don't want to say brutal, but it's like very clear. This is what went on. This is what happened. This is, there's this one author who's talking about, the doctrine of discovery and how, there's actually a translation of Virginia, I forget his last name, the guy who allegedly discovered America, Christopher Columbus. So I actually found some translations of their journals and of their reports back to England or Portugal, and the documentation of what they found. So it's like really an interesting puzzle, putting it all together to see the cultures that were essentially destroyed through colonization and sort of the claiming of the land and the genocide of so many people. But I feel that because these authors are writing for essentially themselves, their own culture, that they have nothing to hide. Because I don't think they're trying to make an indictment. They're just trying to say, well, this is what's happened, and we want a record and we want a dispute. I'm going to have to, I don't know why. I think I'm just tired. That's why I can't think of. Somebody will call and tell me the name of the guy who claimed to have discovered America. If you want to call in, the number is 718-780-8888. I know his name. He goes by the name of Americus. But one of the documents I found showed that wasn't actually his name, and that his America, or what did they say, was Amaru or something like that, was actually the indigenous name of this continent. And then once it was conquered, he took that name. So I thought that was kind of interesting that he took the name as his name. And then there's this one author who goes into this whole logic of why they chose to say that America was named after this explorer rather than the other way around. Hello, you're on the air. Hello? Oh, what happened? You left? Okay. That number is 718-780-8888. So anyway, I'm putting together all this material, because there's always going to be another fun drive. Mm-hmm. So, So I'm going to make it available to people because, I mean, I'm a little bit not in my best time frame. You know, I'm much sharper in the morning than at this hour of the morning. It's more like after sleep into the early morning, my mind is much sharper. But, yeah, so I'm just, so these are actual documents, and they're coming from the Library of Congress. They're coming from their old, you know, documents that have been sort of copied by, what is it, Gutenberg does copies and Google does copies of old out-of-print books. But what I find really interesting in this whole process is the most damning of the books are very hard to get copies of. I hear about them, and then I am unable to actually find them. I have two calls coming in. I'm going to put you on hold, both of you, so please do hang on, okay? Let's see if we can make this work. So now if you are calling, you're now on hold, and I'm going to take your call one at a time. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes.
Thanks for the show.
Oh, you're welcome.
If I'm not mistaken, from memory, because we were forced to remember these things in my childhood education, it's Americados Vespucci.
Americados. Cados.
Vespucci.
Vespucci.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Okay. Anything else you want to add?
It's just horrible. It's beyond words.
Okay. Thank you so much. Bye-bye. Okay. Let's see. I think we have another call. Hello. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
The person whose name is involved with the continent is known as Americo Vespucci.
Americo Vespucci, okay.
And Josephine Baker's birthday is alleged to be June 3rd.
June 3rd.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. do you have anything else you wanted to add?
Well, you mentioned something about the reports of Columbus.
Yes.
I don't think he was reporting to England. He was reporting to Spain, if anyone, because...
Oh, yeah, I thought it was Portugal. Spain, yeah, you're right. Spain, Portugal.
Well, maybe parts of Spain, but some of the Spanish king, the royalty, sent him over to wherever.
Okay. Well, that's... Thank you for your assistance.
Have a good morning. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Yeah, that's cool. so it's America Vespucci and Columbus with Spain and Portugal. So that's what it is. Those are the countries. So I'm going to see if I can find a little bit more coherent an explanation by actually looking at it. No, I won't be able to find it because I don't have my email open. But let's see if I can... Oh, I know. It's on my flash drive. Well, let's play a little music. And then I'm going to check, see if I can find some of that document so that I can actually share it with you. So let's play a little bit more Prince and some Young Rascals. And Blind Faith, how does that sound?
Yeah.
Okay.
I never meant to call you when you sorrow.
never meant to cause you any pain. We'll be right back.
Shouting from the mountain, all out
And that was Blind Faith, Can't Find My Way Home. And we heard Young Rascals, People Got to Be Free, and from Prince, Purple Rain. I loved that movie. It was one of my favorite movies of all time, actually.
Mine too.
It's when I fell in love with Prince. I thought it was such a beautiful movie, and it was interesting too, because he actually evolved a lot in his music. Prince did. His initial music was kind of racy and sexy, and you know, kind of shallow in a way.
He wanted the attention.
Yeah,
got the attention.
But then he. His music seemed to mature and deepen, though he was extremely talented. He played like 18 instruments, and you know, so he was extremely talented. Wrote a lot of music for different artists.
Yeah, I remember when his first album came out, and him with his big fro, and he had this really rich. It was experimental. But he dubbed everything. So all of the background voices, you'd think it was a choir, actually it was all him. And all of the music tracks. So it was, you know, it was really wonderful for this guy to have this kind of musicality and sense of harmony and basically be able to actually create all the voices himself.
Do you remember what that album was called?
For You.
I'm going to see if it's on YouTube. I know, it was really interesting. You know, he was just so amazing.
Yeah.
And the thing that was really interesting to me, though, I was really glad that I spent those few minutes at the Prince party because as I was watching him perform, it occurred to me that this is what self-mastery looks like, in the sense that he perfected his craft, his art, his expression. Everything about him was part of the message of who he was. Every hair, his makeup, if he was wearing jewelry, the clothing, his moves, his music, everything he spoke was like this whole harmonized expression that was, you know, that was him. I guess you would say the person formerly known as Prince, because wasn't going by that name anymore.
Yeah.
So it made me realize, no, I don't see it here on YouTube.
Okay.
Too bad. Yeah, let's see if I just look up his full name. Yeah, I think his probably his newest stuff is here, but not his older stuff. Yeah, so he was just really a fascinating human being, and so when I was watching him, I actually felt really inspired. Because I found that I wanted to not be like him, but to move into my own mastery in that way, to be totally me. And I think I have been working on this, how old am I, since the day I was born. But I think he really did it. He really did it in a way that few people do. That few people really do. So it's interesting. Well, there's a lot here on the guy, but I don't see that particular piece. Oh, well. Anyway, so it's really interesting. I have to be careful. I can't just play stuff because not all of his music is rated for radio.
Yeah.
So I don't want to just pick something at random. So I've been working on this whole self-mastery thing, and it was really inspiring for those few minutes to watch him in his element, you know, the stage and his performance, and it's like he's so big in his performance. He was a very kind of a petite man, but he was so huge in his performance, and his energy was so huge that you could see that the effect he had on the audience, it just rippled through the whole crowd, and he was like, he was just a master of the whole element. And I found that very inspiring, because I think that I'm very good at what I do, but I am not out there in a way that he was able to display. Of course, I have a different astrological sign, so I have a different personality. But there's a way in which his presence on the screen did inspire me to think that I could be more of who I am. Hmm. So I thought that was really interesting. And so I'm, because there are a lot of things that I want to do that are a little bit out there on the edge. I already live pretty far out on the edge, but I want to go further out on the edge of things and really move deeper into a level of mastery of my own life and begin to really explore alchemy, you know, ancient science of alchemy. And, you know, to create and change things with the force of, I guess it's just really the energetic force that allows you to do that. So I'm going to be experimenting with that. And so I'll have to give Prince some credit, because I think I can transform myself into something new. So I'll be exploring that and see what I come up with. But I think a lot of it, I think one of the things that I have not exercised enough is self-discipline in terms of training, in terms of, you know, just lifestyle issues, you know, dietary choices, things like that. You know, there are things that I could do, I think, to increase my mastery and strength that I haven't been doing, essentially because I'm lazy. You know, I like to sleep.
It's not lazy that you like to sleep. All humans like to sleep, I would think.
Yeah, well, no, it's true. It is true, but, you know, part of it is that I have experienced a difference. I was a marathoner for about 13, 14 years. I did a marathon, at least one marathon a year. A couple of times I did two a year. And I was never fast. You know, it took me 6-7 hours to do a marathon. But I was doing it, and I was training all year long, and I would get into these races and, you know, do races all year long, and I was very fit and very strong, and I would train with weights. And so I was strictly vegetarian when I was doing all that as well. So so there was a level of experience that I had that let me feel and experience the difference. The reason I wouldn't characterize that as mastery so much, even though it was a significant chunk of time, is because I was doing it in a group. So, you know, I was in Gary Knoll's Natural Living Running and Walking Club. And so we would train together, and we would go to races together, and we would, you know, support each other in a way that it became more of as much a social lifestyle as it was a physical and health lifestyle. And so when I drifted away from that group, I drifted away from training. Mm. So to me, that's not really the self-mastery. Self-mastery is, from my perspective of how I'm looking at it now, is really getting out there and doing it on a regular basis, you know, to really focus and try to bring it into a rhythm, you know, so that, you know, to just get back into it. It's interesting. I have that focus and self-mastery with regard to the Qigong practice, because to me that's like breathing. Mm-hmm. So I don't have a problem with that. I can do that every day without a problem. I can meditate every day without a problem. I can meditate for hours without a problem. And so, you know, and maybe that's just the way the rhythm of life is, because back when I was training, I wasn't really meditating. And then once I started getting into deeper into the spiritual work, everything slowed down for me, and I wasn't interested in getting out there and running and race walking. So maybe it's just the natural rhythm of life. Maybe I'm not lazy. Maybe
I don't
it's just
think you're lazy at all. Yeah, I think you're. I mean, from what you're saying, it sounds like you're basically following your body. You're being true to your body. So
yeah,
I don't think that's lazy at all.
Yeah, that's true. I guess that's being a little bit harsh, but I'll see what happens. So my birthday is this month as well. Your birthday is this month.
Yes,
so happy
indeed.
Birthday!
Happy birthday to you too.
And so I'm not like putting this into I'm going to do this like the quick fix thing. I'm just going to look at myself from this birthday to my next birthday.
Okay.
So that gives me a little space. I don't have to feel like I'm, you know, because for me, dieting never works kind of thing. It's like when you crunch yourself into something, to me, it's never lasting, or at least for me. And so I'm just going to see how I can fine-tune the mastery of the physical self. I think I'm very good at mastering energetically. I'm very good at that. I think I am a master as far as that's concerned, working with energy. In terms of my creative capacity and broadcast capacity, I have mastery in a lot of areas. Physically, not so much. So let's see what I can do in a year. It'll be interesting.
Well, I guess I'm new to all of this, you know, this radio stuff.
Yeah.
And so it's quite the adventure, you know. I feel as if I've had the unusual opportunity to have learned from the best.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's all been by osmosis. And so I'm, you know, going in with whatever instincts I have, and seeing what works and you know, what's effective and how to improve things over time and to get mm-hmm. past the nervousness. And so it's a really extraordinary experience. In terms of my own sort of mastery, I think I tend to have a lot of nervous energy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people will tell me that I have very calming energy about me. It's just that I tend to control it. So I've had friends where they're going through their own drama. They want me near them just to calm them down.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have to say anything.
Yeah, I have that impact on people too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been the oddest thing. But in terms of like the physical things, I think I'm actually closer to where I want to be.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I'm not really into structured exercise. I just don't see the point. But I do what I like. So when I go to work every day, I have to walk half a mile every day, because
mm-hmm.
I have to walk a half a mile from the train station to my job and back.
Mm-hmm.
So I get that exercise. So every week I'm walking 5 miles.
Mm-hmm.
Every month it's 20 miles.
Well, that's excellent. I mean, I walk a lot as well, but I have a different metabolism than you do. And so my metabolism is such that I tend to sort of stay steady where I am, so I have to really take measures if I want to change. I have to really work on the metabolism. And so there's a certain level of exercise. I don't think everybody needs this, but certainly for my body type, that you have to find your set point, which means that you have to go to your max. And so in order to shift the rate at which you burn calories and the rate at which you metabolize. So because I have a tendency to be very quiet, very slow, very measured, very soft. And so it causes my metabolism to be easy, you know. And so because I don't rush anywhere. I just don't rush anywhere.
That's pretty cool.
I don't rush anywhere.
I'd love to be like that.
I don't, you know, it's like I'm just a really easy going. But in order to jumpstart the metabolism for me, I recognize that I have to do something physically to move into that state, to get a new set point. Because what happens is if I stay at whatever pace I'm at, my body adjusts very quickly, and then it'll remain stationary. Then I have to shift into another gear in order for my metabolism to change. But very quickly, it'll stabilize. Then I have to shift into another gear. That's why long-distance running worked very well for me. Because in the training of long-distance, I kept going, shifting into higher gears of distance, so my body's metabolism kept shifting until it revved up to the point that that it really changed my body type. So, and I think it's different, you know, people have to think about how their metabolism works.
Sure.
And to do what works for them. So, for instance, you were very thin as a child.
Yes.
I find, yeah. I was never thin. I wasn't fat as a child, but I was never thin. You know, I was one of these young girls who developed really, really early. And so it's like I started menstruating when I was in the fourth grade, I think.
Wow.
I was wearing a bra when I was in the fourth and fifth grade. I was fully developed, fully physically developed in fourth or fifth grade. So, so my metabolism is, you know, people just have to work with understanding how their body functions and then work with that in order to make a transformation. And so I guess one of the reasons that I have been saying that I've been undisciplined about it is because essentially, truthfully, I don't care.
And you're honest.
I don't really care. I mean, you know, I'm comfortable in my body. I think I have a beautiful body. I think that, you know, I'm just cool with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think I'm at my prime physical capacity. And so I want to shift back into seeing what that feels like at my age. Because when I was doing the training and all that stuff, I was between 30 and 40. Now, my next birthday, I'm going to be 61. So I want to shift back into that optimum physical state because I want to be able to actually decelerate aging, and I want to actually go the other way. I want to become more youthful. And see, this is what I was talking about in terms of alchemy, because a lot of what I do with energy on the Qigong level, it's about alchemy. It's about keeping your physical body in a state of perpetual strength and, I won't say youth, but strength, vitality. And so energetically, I do very well with that. I think I'm very vital. But I want to see how further I can tweak it by also being physically sharp, you know, and in really good physical shape as well. So I'm just curious to see, so that when I come around to being 62, which means I'll be at the age of pseudo retirement, though I've already retired from working, but at least 9 to 5. But so I want to see, because like as it currently, I'm doing pretty good. You know, I think most people would guess my age to be at least 10 years younger, maybe 20. So let's see if by the time I get to be 60, people will think I'm 30.
Okay. All right.
This is my birthday gift to myself for this year.
Since you revealed your age, and I have no qualms about revealing mine, so my next birthday I'll be 53.
That's pretty cool. Well, I would never think that.
Well,
but it's cool. You know, it's like aging is so much different than it was in our grandparents' day. I can remember looking at old yearbooks, and I'm looking at people who were graduating from high school and college, and they already look really old.
I know.
You know,
and I've seen that.
And it's very strange how the mentality has an impact on how people age and how they look.
And stress level.
And the stress
how
level.
How you live.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So, you know, all those things really matter.
Genetics.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think genetics is the least impactful.
I think for me, I think my own personal kind of goal was not to ever, to be at the point where my weight would never be a negative factor in my health.
Mm.
And so I spent most of my life being kind of slender.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier on, I was very thin and I couldn't gain weight, so I was very, very self-conscious. And so once I finally started, figured out, you know, what had gone wrong and so forth, I was comfortable, you know, being a certain size and walking all the time, and I think was my lifestyle, really. It wasn't intentional.
Mm-hmm.
It was just the way it was. And so I guess because of the circumstances and, you know, the last couple of years, you know, you go through your stress and what have you, but then you start to sort of, like you, I started to listen to my body again.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm very conscious of, you know, what exactly am I putting into my body? What do I need? And so it sort of shrank.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, yeah, that happened to me too. Yeah, in the last year, 2 years, I've probably dropped, I don't know, 30 pounds, I suppose, maybe more.
I think I dropped a similar amount of weight in the last 24 months. But it's just the sense of sort of being at the place where I'm happy in my own skin.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm almost there. And that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. I don't feel like I have to be self-conscious or what have you. I am who I am.
Well, that's beautiful. And I agree with you. I'm very happy in my skin. I'm very happy with my body type. I'm happy with my weight, really. I'm happy with my strength. There's nothing that I would degrade in myself. I think everything is pretty cool. But I'm looking for optimization at this point. I'm looking for mastery. You know, I'm looking for that. I want to be able to have my field, my body, my mind, my energy field such that I can do masterful things like bilocate. Like I'm in many ways what I do is shamanic. And what traditionally what shamanic shamans can do is to shape shift. Is to bilocate, is to be in, you know, more than one place at a time. And so because once we start to integrate the quantum nature of reality, then we can do things, this, you know, what's done on a micro level can also be done on a macro level.
Mm.
And shaman traditionally have been able to do things that in quantum science they only have little quarks doing, you know. But so I'm looking to do that kind of thing. And people might think it's odd, but really I have been working with the energy in Qigong, you know, I guess it, I keep saying 20 years for the last 5 years, so it's probably longer, but I'm really shifting into an experiential quantumness and understanding it on that level, that you can get into certain states and really shift. You can shift your body. You can shift your state of mind. You can shift, disease. You can shift a lot just with the state of your awareness and your mastery of the energy. So I'm doing a lot of that anyway, but I want to see how deep it can get.
Okay.
It should be good interesting. It'll be fun.
Oh, yeah.
We're out of time, aren't we?
We
just sat here and talked and talked. We were like, I don't have anything to talk about. I don't know what we're going to talk about. Here we are. Yeah, here we are. So we're out of time, folks. I did want to mention, speaking of Qigong, I'm doing a Saturday class ongoing. It's from 2 to 3 in Brooklyn at a place called Studio Maya, which is on Bergen Street. And it's a great class. And we're teaching Qigong from the perspective of its quantum nature. It's Qigong practice, traditional Qigong practice, but adding to it, marrying it with the more deeper understanding of quantum reality. So anyone who wants to participate in that can. And also next week, Wednesday, which is I think the 18th of June, is the Heart of Mind Spiritual Support Group. 15th of June. The Heart of Mind Spiritual Support Group. We meet once a month and we work with each other on different kinds of spiritual conversation. We talk about this kind of quantum understanding. We help each other through various health issues or emotional, psychological. It's a really beautiful experience as well, and that's at Jnana Yoga. I wonder if there's dust in the room. You're both coughing. So that's coming next Wednesday. So anyone who is interested, please drop an email to me at heartofmindradio@gmail.com, and I will send that information to you. Or you can check the Qigong website, qigongonline.net, QIGONGONLINE.net. We're going to play a little music as we welcome in Jim Freund and Hour of the Wolf. Oh.
His fights were dance and force, the sheen of sweat on muscle, wit in eyes, sharp angry tongue. He was so beautiful when he was young, still so when he had started to forget, and faced his maimed old age with equal grace, as on his day in court, great to refuse a war a name his people did not choose. His art was punching people in the face and being punched. The insults to his brain accumulate. We watch, we can admire an energy, destruction, brilliance, fire, and hope we never see his like again. The greatest and the best, his vicious skill, but greatest when he said he would not kill.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Ferrino. With me, Roz Caveney. This will be heard at the beginning, so you know it's going to be a great show. We'll have a new program first, and then I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. The big question I had in watching X-Men Apocalypse was, why is this movie set in 1983?
After all, the bulk of the preceding X-Men film, Days of Future Past, was set in 1973 and made good use of taking the franchise's themes of fighting against fear and bigotry and playing them against the administration of arguably the most paranoid president in American history, Richard Nixon. But if there's anything in 1983 that's supposed to resonate with those themes, I couldn't find it in Apocalypse, and it appears the only reason for the period setting is that it allows the producers to go with a younger and presumably cheaper cast. That was a non-starter with X-Men First Class and was supposed to be the thing director Bryan Singer fixed in Days of Future Past. But no, it works no better here, even with Singer still at the helm. Part of the problem is that there's no real sense of period here. The film might as well have been set in 2016, for all that matters. And that generic feel extends to all aspects of X-Men Apocalypse. From the title, there are over a million words in the English language. You think the producers could find a more unique qualifier than Apocalypse to the film's general threat? En-Sabah Nur, played by Oscar Isaac, an ancient Egyptian demigod-slash-mutant who wants to wipe the world clean of humans, to the unconvincingly CG-stuffed action sequences. There are attempts to make Nur's quest to create a mutant kingdom play against the rivalry between the pacific Professor X, once again played by James McAvoy, and the revolution-by-any-means-necessary Magneto, Michael Fassbender again, but they are half-hearted at best. And weirdly, for a plotline that threatens the extermination of humanity, humans have very little to do with proceedings overall, being represented mostly by a handful of soldiers and a CIA agent and possible love interest for Professor X, played by Rose Byrne, who was last seen in First Class and who had her memory wiped at the end of that film, the effects of which appear to have extended into the audience, because I had no memory of her either. Given its over 2-hour runtime, X-Men Apocalypse is kind of a slog. There's been talk recently that the Marvel franchise films have been running out of steam. Deadpool, Captain America Civil War, and Marvel's various Netflix series would argue against that, but if you were looking for a prime example for the argument, you wouldn't be wrong to cite X-Men Apocalypse. So let me run down a few other things that might put a spring back into your step. Therapy for a Vampire is a jaunty little Austrian comedy set in 1930s Vienna that manages to jumble a struggling artist, his actualized girlfriend, a tortured, blood-sucking count, his much-despised, vain, and similarly undead wife, and Sigmund Freud together into a farce of confused motivations and thwarted desires. Director and writer David Rohm gives the film a classy, technicolor ambience and throws in some witty observations into the issues of female identity to boot. It's fun and lighthearted, and among an overall fine cast, Tobias Moretti stands out as the occasionally charismatic, occasionally frustrated, occasionally befuddled count. It's as delightful as horror comedy can get. I laughed. Much, much darker is the Korean horror film The Wailing, about a small mountain town whose residents are succumbing to a murderous form of hysteria. Director Na Hong-jin walks a fine line between the real and the supernatural, getting considerable disturbing mileage from an ambiguous portrayal of the evil gripping the town. In the past few years, Korea has led the way in films that tap hitherto unexplored veins of horror, and The Wailing is another atmospheric example. Kinda blew me away. I'm Dan Persons. If this past week has taught us anything, it's that it is time to take a stand against hatred, fear, and greed. Register to vote, and let's defeat Trump.
Really, really. And this is a guy who doesn't get very political, but, you know, it's just we are, you know.
This isn't politics. This is survival.
It is. It really is.
I mean, because the gloves are off all around the world and the lights are going out.
And if people, and it, you know, they don't like the presumptive other candidate. Many people don't. And so they're like, well, maybe Trump isn't so bad. And this is like, maybe Hitler wasn't so bad.
Yeah, it's 1933 and the Reichstag is
burning. Yeah, this is Weimar, New York.
Yeah, and it's Weimar, London, too.
Is it also?
Mm-hmm. Because of the referendum. To withdraw from the European Union.
Ah, what we're calling the Brexit is the only word that I see in the news.
But you see,
here,
there's a package with that, which is that bad as Cameron is, and I detest Cameron, the people who will replace him after Brexit, and possibly if Brexit losers will nonetheless manage to mount a coup against him, are people who are even worse than Cameron.
Yeah, right. And that's often the case. Do me a favor and grab that other microphone over there.
This one?
Yeah. One that works, let's put it that way.
Oh, right.
Oh, much better.
Okay.
Much better. Good morning, everybody listening, or good evening if you're listening to in some other part of the world or on the podcast or archive or whatever. I am Jim Freund. With me, Roz Kaveny, who for years I've been mispronouncing her name.
Everyone does it. It's just one of those things. It's like death, taxes, and mispronunciation of the name Kaveny.
And also because I'm the host of Lightspeed Magazine podcasts, get people's names right.
Well,
it's their identity. Respect the identity, and that starts with a name.
This is true. It's magic. Names are magic. Names, real names are magic.
Once you know something's true name, and we're going back to T.S. Eliot here.
Yes.
You know, forget Le Guin. Once you know that name, you have the full power over it, or at least a connection with it.
Yes.
And so, and I have to tell, once upon a time, I actually had a corporate life. I was a network manager, but doing it for a major bank. And they sent me, for God knows what reason, to the Dale Carnegie course on how to win friends and influence people.
Good Lord, you mean that's a real thing?
It's a real thing. And
good
I've,
Lord.
And it is worthless except for the first class, which is the first chapter of that book. And what that is how to know somebody's name, how to remember their name. And it will say, there is nobody in the world who will not be happier if you get their name right, and if you can remember it. And I'll tell a very quick story that one time I met Bill Gates under particular circumstances in a crowd of people, and then I saw him about a year and a half later, and he remembered my name and our association. He did that Da Vinci Cathedral of Mind,
yes,
kind of thing.
Well, there's that wonderful description in Primary Colors,
yes,
of how the guy who isn't your 40th president, but is a sort of simulacrum of him, has this way of taking people by one hand and pushing the other hand on their arm and calling them by name.
Yes, and they do that so well in the movie.
Yeah.
Which brings us to the fact that you are also a media critic.
Yes. Well,
so I have a question for you.
By all means.
I have given up on the idea that Adrian Lester should be the doctor, but a friend of mine gave me a wonderful idea. Adrian Lester as Simon Templar.